Welcome to the Hannah Miller Show. And here she is, Hannah Miller.
Outspokenly conservative and unashamedly Christian, this is Hannah Miller, and this is what happened this week. So, of course, this week started June, and June is Pride Month, hashtag, and on June 2nd, Tatiana McGrath tweeted, "It takes real courage for major corporations to display the pride rainbow colors in our homophobic and heteronormative culture. And yet, how wonderful to see that the Arab states are so progressive that the corporations don't even have to bother." And of course, alongside of that tweet was all of these snapshots of the different social media pages of Microsoft, Lenovo, Cisco, BMW, Mercedes-Benz, YouTube, Procter & Gamble, and Bethesda, just to name a few, who decided that the United States and Western country social media pages should have hashtag Pride Month everywhere. But then when you look at the Arab states and their social media pages for the Arab states, absolutely nothing on those pages. And so Tatiana is just being satirical here, and I love it because this next level troll, in my honest opinion. Here's the thing. According to Human Dignity Trust, a UK-based global nonprofit dedicated to LGBT rights, homosexuality remains a crime in 70 countries worldwide, plus Palestine. At least 11 jurisdictions warrant homosexuality worthy of the death penalty. If corporate America really possessed a genuine commitment to LGBT acceptance, they would be engaging in substantial activism abroad, where homosexuality is literally a death sentence. Instead, they're just doing it here. You know why? Because we're not homophobic, and we're not hate-filled, and nobody actually really cares here in the United States. Nobody's beheading anybody, or stoning them in the streets, or following through with honor killings. That's what they call them. Honor killings. It's not going on here. So these organizations, these businesses, are just trying to get their little sticker, but they don't actually care, because if they did, they would be going to the front lines and battling this thing out. But there's not a peep on any of their social media pages for those countries. Meanwhile, the GOP chairwoman, Ronna McDaniel, tweeted this on June 2nd. "Happy hashtag Pride Month. At GOP is proud to have doubled our LGBTQ support over the last 4 years, and we will continue to grow our big tent by supporting measures that promote fairness and balance protections for LGBTQ Americans and those with deeply held religious beliefs." Look, obviously, I don't have a problem with folks of any kind who want to preserve our Constitution, but inevitably, the GOP won't be able to navigate this tightrope between conserving the Constitution, which they do a rather poor job of anyway, and embracing LGBTQ Americans. Why do I believe that? Because our Constitution was founded on biblical principles, and you cannot separate those two without either completely abandoning the biblical foundation of our Constitution, of our Christianity. The reason? Because our Constitution was founded on biblical principles, and you cannot separate those two without either completely abandoning the biblical foundation of our Constitution, which will not, by definition, be conserving it, or completely undermining what Christianity says about sexual perversions. Eventually, this tightrope will lead to the GOP either abandoning the LGBTQ or abandoning Christians. Which do you believe they will leave behind? What does their history tell us they will do? One of my favorite illustrations of the GOP and the DNC and the Democrats is by Steve Dace, who says, "The Democrats, the progressive liberals, they're in a car going down the interstate, and they're flying just as fast as they can go. They're going 110 miles down the interstate, and they see the exit off to progressive and utopia communism land, and they swerve across 6 lanes of traffic to get over there, never pumping their brakes, never checking their mirrors. They're going just as fast as they can." And then you have the GOP. And we're over here in a car going down the interstate, and we're going 85 miles an hour. And we see the exit towards super progressivism, socialism, communism, whatever have you. And we check both of our mirrors. We look around a little bit. We speed up just a tad. And then we take all the lanes across and go up the exit ramp. We're all going in the same direction. It's just that the Republicans tend to go a little faster, a little slower, if you're looking at our history. Look, furthermore, as I said above and previously, the GOP already does a poor job conserving our Constitution. What makes us think they will suddenly grow some discernment now on how to navigate this, especially when they lack any kind of biblical discernment and most are constitutionally illiterate as well? Look, many folks will disagree with me on this, and you may as well, but I said what I said. All right, let's move down to the southern border. Governor Greg Abbott on Tuesday issued a disaster declaration along the southern border of Texas in response to an ongoing surge of illegal immigrants. The Republicans' declaration allows the use of all available state resources to assist state and local law enforcement in protecting Texans from criminal activity and property damage. Quoting Abbott, he said, "President Biden's open border policies have paved the way for dangerous gangs and cartels, human traffickers, and deadly drugs like fentanyl to pour into our communities. Meanwhile, landowners along the border are seeing their property damaged and vandalized on a daily basis, while the Biden administration does nothing to protect them." Since March, Abbott said that the Texas Department of Public Safety has made over 1,300 criminal arrests, apprehended over 35,000 illegal migrants, and seized over 10,000 pounds of drugs and over 100 firearms. In the first 4 months of 2021, the DPS in Texas seized nearly 95 pounds of fentanyl, an opioid for pain treatment that's between 50 and 100 times more potent than morphine. It was enough of the drug to administer 21.5 million lethal doses. And according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, more than 36,000 people died from overdoses involving synthetic opioids like fentanyl in 2019. More on that in a minute. Abbott directed the DPS to enforce all federal and state criminal laws, including criminal trespassing, smuggling, and human trafficking. He also directed the Texas Health and Human Services Commission to, quote, take all necessary steps to discontinue state licensure of any child care facility under a contract with the federal government that shelters or detains unlawful immigrants. First of all, what took so long? I mean, really, it's June. It's the first week of June. How long did you need this to go on? I've actually been pretty disappointed in Texas and Greg Abbott for quite a while. I think that they stayed on the COVID train for way too long. I think that they stayed with masks for way too long. The shutdown's way too long. A lot of that, I have been disappointed with Greg Abbott. I think that they also, this has taken way too long, in my personal opinion, what's been the holdup on declaring this is a major issue. And then furthermore, they have a high profile case on transgender, on hormone therapy and sex reassignment surgery for minors. And that's the Jeff Younger and James Younger case. And that situation has been totally glossed over by Greg Abbott and a lot of the Republicans in Texas. And that's been very disappointing to me because that seems like a no-brainer. You know, an 8-year-old, a 6-year-old, when this all started, should not be forced by a parent to have any kind of hormone therapy or sex change therapy or sex reassignment surgery. I mean, it's literally mutilation of a child being forced on him by his mom because of something that he said when he was like 4. And it's absolutely ludicrous. And even if he was the one that was saying, continuing to say that that's what he wants, which he's not, it's crazy we would even consider it being permissible, even if it's what a 6-year-old wanted. Because you know what? They're a 6-year-old. They don't know what they want. My 6-year-old changes her mind about what she wants for lunch 14 times before we actually have lunch. So something this important? Give me a break. Have half a brain. That's a totally different topic. But it's been very disappointing to me. The Texas Republicans, really, overall. And then some of the violence that they have allowed to happen with some of the rioting this last year that I think Greg Abbott and others should have put the kibosh in a lot earlier and come down harder on a lot earlier. But, I mean, I guess better late than never, I suppose. But I would just encourage, if you're in Texas, to be thinking about the fact that this was really late. And a lot of these other things he was late on board with as well. And so, talking about fentanyl and what's going on at the southern border. More than 70,000 Americans died from drug-involved overdose in 2019, including illicit drugs and prescription opioids. That's all from all drug-involved overdose. Combining all drug overdoses other than fentanyl, 36,359 Americans died from drug-involved overdose in 2019, which means fentanyl alone is responsible for 34,271 deaths. Fentanyl alone doubled drug-involved overdoses in 2019. Doubled them. While the government is cracking down on doctors like my dad and dentists like my dentist, who I went in to have oral surgery, I had to have a gum graft, which can be quite painful. They resisted prescribing me a pain medication because the government's cracking down on them as dentists and my dad as a doctor, cracking down on them prescribing prescription drugs. So while they're doing that, while the government's coming down on these doctors who are just for the most part trying to help their patients, the southern border, where our primary concern should be because of what we just heard, how many lethal doses in the first 4 months of this year? 21.5 million lethal doses of fentanyl in just 4 months confiscated at the southern border. That should be our primary concern if we're all about the opioid crisis. Everybody likes to talk about the opioid crisis and trying to stop the opioid crisis. And all of our direction and our attention is on doctors and dentists and the such who, are, for the most part, like I've said, they're just trying to help their patients. Our primary concern should be the southern border for obvious reasons that I've just stated. Yet the southern border is wide open. Yet again, the U.S. government demonstrates, at best, their complete ineptitude, and at worst, their malevolence. What other explanation is there when you're looking at these facts? So, what else happened this week? On June 1st, Biden pinpointed the greatest threat to Homeland Security by saying, "We must not give hate a safe harbor." As I said in my address to the joint sessions of Congress, according to the intelligence community, terrorism from white supremacy is the most lethal threat to the homeland today. Not ISIS, not Al-Qaeda, white supremacists, Biden said. Now, I'm going to give you one number to show you that 21st century white supremacists are the worst white supremacists of all time. According to the National Crime Victimization Survey, published by the Bureau of Justice Statistics, out of the 593,598 interracial violent crimes committed in 2018 between blacks and whites, 9.5% were white against black, and 90% were black against white. I'll say that one more time. According to the National Crime Victimization Survey, published by the Bureau of Justice Statistics, out of the 593,598 interracial violent crimes committed in 2018 between blacks and whites, 9.5% were white against black, and 90% were black against white. And that's all I have to say about that. All right. So, the big story of the week. The Fauci emails. Which, by the way, is why we were suddenly allowed to begin theorizing aloud about the origins of COVID last week. They were doing some proactive damage control, in my opinion. I did wonder about that. So, BuzzFeed, of all places, I know. But hey, sometimes we just gotta fight the battles in front of us with the soldiers beside us. And today, that soldier is BuzzFeed. Anyway, BuzzFeed just released over 3,000 emails between Fauci and numerous persons that BuzzFeed had received under a Freedom of Information Act request. I'm not going to go into all of it, but I will try to summarize a few points that stand out to me and respond to a few of the arguments already being made by the COVID cult. Number one, Fauci had sensitive discussions about the gain-of-function research he has denied under oath at the U.S. Senate. He did very early February and March of last year, 2020. He had some discussions about that gain-of-function research in these emails, and of course now he's denied it under oath. Number two, Fauci admitted February 5th, 2020, and I quote, "Masks are really for infected people to prevent them from spreading infection to people who are not infected, rather than protecting uninfected people from acquiring infection. The typical mask you buy in the drugstore is not really effective in keeping out virus, which is small enough to pass through the material. I do not recommend that you wear a mask, particularly since you're going into a very low-risk location." Some folks are defending Fauci on this because at the same time, he was publicly saying masks didn't work. And while it is true that he flip-flopped in public on this at the same time, he clearly states in the email that they don't work because the droplets are too small to be stopped by a retail mask. He never made that point in public. Furthermore, he nor the CDC strongly differentiated between homemade masks, drugstore masks, N95s, etc. He was often seen in public with a homemade mask, a significant occasion being at the Major League Baseball game where he also took it off while sitting amongst friends in close quarters, something he had also discouraged. The scientific fact that COVID-19 particles were too small to be stopped by drugstore masks never changed. So now we have to ask, why the change of heart by Fauci to defending masks nearly indefinitely, and at one point, even two masks? All right, number three. Fauci stated on February 4th, 2020, that, quote, "most transmissions occur from someone who is symptomatic, not asymptomatic." So this begs the question, why the lockdowns, Tony? Again, the science never actually changed, no matter how loudly Fauci claims that now science is dynamic. And that's a quote. Science can change. I don't disagree with that. But there should be some evidence to science actually changing somewhere for you to base such a drastic public policy decisions on that so-called change. Number four. On March 14th, 2020, Fauci received the most important advice regarding COVID-19 mitigation efforts, in my opinion, presumably from University Penn researcher Michael Betts. And he promptly responded, "thank you for your note." And that was it. This advice, quoting, and I'm going to read you pretty much the whole letter from Michael Betts because it's exactly right. "We know that the virus is especially dangerous for the old and/or immunosuppressed. In my opinion, we should be focusing all of our efforts on keeping that group from becoming infected. To do so, that group should be encouraged to self-isolate, to limit their social interactions, and other groups should be instructed to avoid them. Sort of a reverse quarantine idea. All testing would be done within those groups, and all groups would also be encouraged to continue with the hygienic suggestions they've already received. The problem right now is the media has created a panic. Last night, my wife and I went to the local Whole Foods, and many of the shelves were empty, and healthy younger people wearing masks. The message is not getting out that the virus is almost solely dangerous to the elderly and immunosuppressed. Why aren't the demographics being released? That in itself could calm many people. With my suggestions, exposures to them would be diminished, significantly reducing the number of deaths, as well as the potential impact on hospitals. Any person outside of that group that was severely affected could be identified and treated. Quarantining otherwise healthy people outside of those groups who finally demonstrate symptoms, like the NBA players, is ridiculous. They're likely to get the sniffles and have also already spread the virus. As long as they're not spreading it to the endangered group, we should not worry about it. In sum, we need to isolate the vulnerable and realize that the mortality rate for people outside of that group is likely lower than the flu. Of course, while this occurs, we are working on finding treatments and vaccines. But sending home workers who have next to no likelihood of being significantly impacted by this virus is ridiculous. The virus hits hardest the old and infirm, two groups that are most likely not to even be in the workforce. To me, this solution is a lot simpler than what is being tried right now and is much more likely of success. To everyone besides the endangered group, this virus is literally less dangerous than the flu. There is no reason that anyone outside of the endangered group should have any concern at all, and we need to make that clear. Please let me know what you think. Okay, that's a bit of a long letter, I know, but everything he said in there. Let me go back. This was March 14th. March 14th. We already knew who was at risk, who was in danger, and they were already receiving advice that, hey, maybe these, and if you've got half a brain, I mean, just a half a one, you would be able to understand and agree with what Michael Betts here is saying and why he would say that, hey, we should be focusing in on those who are most vulnerable and telling everybody else to go live their lives. You really don't have to be or have a PhD to be able to understand that. And he says, and the question, why aren't the demographics being released? That in itself could calm many people. He is exactly right. The demographics, why weren't they being released? Why weren't they telling people? The only motivation they could have for not telling people who was actually at risk is that, one, they wanted control of more people. And so they had to, and so two, they had to keep them scared. For what their motivation was or why they were doing this, I'm not entirely sure. But hopefully we'll get to the bottom of it. Number five. Fauci ignored warnings about the suspicious nature and origins of the virus. He received emails from Christian G. Anderson about this. Christian is already on social media in the last couple of days, very condescendingly negating all of this. And he's trying to go with the argument, well, science is dynamic, it's constantly changing. And, you know, I get that. Science does change. Things do get updated. I get that, but it doesn't negate the fact that it was brought to Anthony Fauci's attention very early in the pandemic that there was some things that were suspicious about this, about the nature of the virus and the origins of the virus. And it was treated, and for everybody else to have those same questions and to say, hey, there's something going on, there's something suspicious here, they were treated like a pariah and a conspiracy theorist and completely shut down on various platforms. Number six, Fauci was indeed aware the virus may have come from a lab. And so for both of these last two, though, too much of the emails, in my opinion, were redacted for it to be clear exactly what Fauci either knew or believed at that time about the origins and nature of the virus. They mostly appear to be the concerns of other experts, and Fauci doesn't indicate one way or the other, specifically in the emails, what he believes. But with the additional information we have regarding Fauci's funding of the Wuhan lab, his relationship with many of the folks there and that lab, and his knowledge of gain-of-function research and his willingness to lie about it in that particular lab, it is highly likely that he was at least aware that it was a possibility and still irrevocably denied the possibility of COVID-19 being manufactured in a lab and allowed for other people to be silenced and canceled and shoved off of social media platforms and out of the public square of discussion because they raised the same question. Number seven, Fauci and Zuckerberg teamed up to control the conversation regarding COVID-19 at some level. Okay, the important information in this email was also redacted, so it's unclear what they actually coordinated to do together and whether it was actually nefarious or not. So I don't have information on that, except that I know for the last, those points about the origins of the lab and the nature of it, and then this with Zuckerberg, both of those, the reasons for being redacted, have a lot of questions, and they have indicating that there's some legal aspect and trade secrets, especially with Zuckerberg, that go into effect with this. And so that'll be interesting what that means. I'm not sure. So that's all I have to say about those are kind of some of the things that jumped out at me first and foremost. And I think the biggest things were the email from Michael Betts, where he knew early on it was made clear to him. And like I said, you know, I'm no doctor. I'm no virologist or immunologist or public health expert. But I was able to see pretty early that the people most at risk because, well, first of all, you know, I just knew coronaviruses. And, well, they tend to affect the most people, elderly and immunosuppressed and folks who are overweight or have heart issues and those kinds of things. And so it was not a surprise to me when that information came out, and it shouldn't have been to Anthony Fauci, and it especially wasn't because he was already receiving emails about it and people were asking him, hey, we know this to be true. about the virus. We know who's vulnerable. Why are we not having kind of a spearheaded, focused in response to those folks? So that, and then, you know, he himself said there's most transmissions occur from someone who's symptomatic. Remember, that was the main issue. All these people who thought they were healthy would be running around infecting everybody else because of asymptomatic spread, and so we have to do the lockdowns. The whole reason for the lockdowns, he counteracted it on February 4th, 2020. February 4th, 2020, most transmissions occur from someone who is symptomatic. That never changed. The science never changed on that. And then, of course, the mask thing. So here's some final points regarding all of this and some of my thoughts regarding it overall from the last year. In February 2020, the government felt forced to make a decision between two risky situations. On the one hand, they had a high-risk situation with unknown consequences. COVID-19 running rampant through the country, taking an unknown number of lives. On the other hand, they had a high-risk situation of lockdowns and quarantines with the known, previously documented consequences of depression, anxiety, poverty, suicide, loneliness, medical desertion, high unemployment, small business closures, and a plummeting economy that all also lead to an unknown number of lives being lost. So, with that in mind, these two high-risk situations. First, and most importantly, the government should have never felt forced to make this decision. The governmental overreach was in part because of our own constant looking to the government to save us, and in part because we have previously allowed the government to take more and more control over our lives. We were ripe for the taking. Second, risk-benefit analysis is what the COVID-19 mitigation efforts should have always been about. And that analysis is always a personal decision. Due to the hiding of who was truly in danger and in what circumstances a person was most likely to contract COVID-19, many Americans and people around the world could not make an accurate risk-benefit analysis, and thus they lived in fear for an entire year at least. Third, when faced with two risky situations, it was always either totally ignorant or purposefully malevolent to ignore precedents. With these emails and other information, it appears that Fauci was purposefully inducing fear. But even if you don't believe that and want to believe that Fauci had the best intentions, there's still reason to question Fauci. Hang with me here, all right? In the first scenario I described previously, coronaviruses have precedent. And while COVID-19 was a, quote, novel virus, it was idiocy to completely throw out all scientific study regarding coronaviruses, symptomatic and asymptomatic spread, mask wearing, all of that preceded, all of those things that preceded this moment and the studies that we had, to completely throw them out. And by doing so, we actually made the situation far worse. In the second scenario, the consequences of lockdowns and quarantines also had precedence. It was also idiotic to ignore what history has told us happens following high unemployment and business shutdowns. And again, by ignoring precedence, we made the situation far worse. Government bureaucrats ignored precedents on every level, and on every level, those precedences have come true. Ultimately, which was more of a risk on behalf of Fauci, Birx, and others? To cast out all precedents, assuming the worst of the worst would happen with COVID-19, and the best of the best results would occur with lockdowns? Or to assume that COVID-19 and high unemployment would behave at least somewhat like other coronaviruses and shutdowns? Furthermore, why believe the worst of the worst for one scenario, but not the other? On what grounds was the assumption made that COVID-19 would have completely negative outcomes, while lockdown's consequences would result in completely positive outcomes? If Fauci's and others had listened to medical, scientific, and historical precedents of any kind, their advice would have been vastly different. Proverbs 18:13 says, "If one gives an answer before he hears, it is his folly and shame." I believe this verse applies to hearing all the details, both hearing the current details and the details of situations past. Furthermore, Fauci never, not once, addressed the consequences of the lockdowns, nor did he lament those consequences, nor did he display any level of angst whatsoever with making the decision to lock down. Fauci did not count the cost of lockdowns. This reminds me of what Jesus said in Luke 14, verses 28 through 32. For which one of you, when he wants to build a tower, does not first sit down and calculate the cost to see if he has enough to complete it? Otherwise, when he has laid a foundation and is not able to finish, all who observe it begin to ridicule him, saying, "This man began to build and was not able to finish." Or what king, when he sets out to meet another king in battle, will not first sit down and consider whether he is strong enough with 10,000 men to encounter the one coming against him with 20,000? Or else, while the other is still far away, he sends a delegation and asks for terms of peace. In these verses, Jesus is challenging his disciples to count the cost of making the decision to become his followers. The broader principle, though, applies to all of life, and specifically to Fauci. We should count the cost before making decisions or be mocked for our misjudgment. Finally, in the movie The Dead Poets Society, Robin Williams makes a statement that I've thought much about this past year, as so much of our conversation has revolved around what is essential and what is non-essential. He said this: "Medicine, law, business, engineering, these are noble pursuits and necessary to sustain life. But poetry, beauty, romance, love, these are what we stay alive for. Many of the things we were told were non-essential, weddings, graduations, school dances, award ceremonies, senior recitals, funerals, family gatherings, sports games, church services, and community events, while possibly not what sustains life, these are the things for which we live for and look forward to, and give us meaning in life. This has never been more evident than after this past year, when these things were deemed non-essential, and the levels of hopelessness, loneliness, anxiety, and depression quadrupled, going up from 11% to 41% from 2019 to 2020 in June. So maybe Proverbs 13:12 is right after all. A hope deferred makes the heart sick, but a longing fulfilled is a tree of life.
Thank you for listening to The Hannah Miller Show. Please remember to subscribe to this podcast. This podcast is produced by Bob Sloan Audio Productions. If you'd like to find out more about Hannah or to schedule her for a speaking event, go to her website, thehannahmillershow.com.